Now, did anyone spend any time thinking about this notational question of whether this is indeed problematic or just confusing?
I think,
please.
What you want to do is you want to call, like, say, the left-hand side JA and IB. And then you, so then you kind of apply, you've got a different number, you can have a different number.
But I don't want to sum over I and J.
Right, so I think, yeah, sorry, and then, like, call it A, sorry, A, AI, B, J for the basis.
But then you have to sum over I and J, and it's a single sum.
No, then you sum over, like, I, AI, and BI in the summation. Because, like, you index the I and B with different.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, you index, if you index, like, your HA and HB with different, like, different numbers to start with, then you can find them with different, like, they have different dimensions. Mm-hmm. And then when you get down to this final sum, you
well, I guess
what
I
mean, the
sum is undefined here, so it could be, does, I mean, I leave it undefined, but, and I mean, in principle, you could have the sum be as large as the largest of these two bases, and just the lambda i's would be zero. So I don't see a problem there.
No, it's like, because if you exchange the notation as somebody suggested yesterday, you get, like, if you have, like, a, I, and b, I, then in the brackets, the sum, you're kind of implying that the I runs from, like, the I is from the same set, so mm-hmm. so it means that the bases have same dimension.
So if you
put I and J in the first place, and then you just, like, in the sum you use only I, then
I see.
You kind of resolve that.
So if I just do this, that's fine?
Yeah, that's also cool.
And you're assuming HA here is, like, smaller than HB.
Right.
Yeah.
Something like that. Or I could even leave it, I could even do this, and then it's,
that's still not good because it makes it look like it's
1, 1, 2, 3. Well, that's just the labeling. I can define the labels however I want. I think that's okay.
That's confusing?
Confusing maybe, but okay. I think it's, but here's the thing. This is always something that kind of bothered me, and I never really spent the time sorting out what the best way to, what the best notation is.
You want to substitute?
Question.
Yes.
Is it that the sum we are writing down does not encode all the information about the computation that we are going to do?
To find these bases?
Yes.
It does not. Okay, so, all right, so there were a few extra comments I wanted to make about this, so remarks. Oh, so here, oh, so I should say where lambda I are, lambda k are non-negative, and they sum to 1. We say the state is entangled. If and only if the number of non-zero lambda k is greater than 1. Second remark is that if we have the dimension of HA is equal to the dimension of HB, we'll just call this D, then the state is maximally entangled. If the number of non-zero lambda k is equal to d. And this is true for any state of the form I told you about the reduced states, and the last thing I wanted to mention is the purification of a mixed state. So suppose you have rho A equal to a sum over I pi psi I psi I. This is some density operator. Then we can find a purification of rho A. What that means is i.e., this mixed state is consistent with a pure state on a bigger Hilbert space, pure state in HA tensor HB. And this is given by psi equals sum over I square root of pi psi I A psi I B. Okay, that's all I wanted to say about that. And now, for the rest of the class today, I wanted to talk about, tell you a bit about contextuality and also Poisson brackets. Yeah?
Sorry, I was, you got this thing, you're saying that, like, if the dimension of HA is represented by D, the set maximum entangled the number of lambda k is D.
Mm-hmm.
You can have, like, some of those, like, lambda k's being almost zero, and then they're almost never really contributed. Like the size of lambda, it's not the critical of the one is not zero, the size of lambda k doesn't have to be entangled.
Yeah.
It does seem like as if they would have to be equal for it to be maximum.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point.
In fact, I think that the saying like, you know, the measure of entanglement being the number of non-zero k is probably it's definitely a measure of whether or not you have entanglement. But you could have, say, two states, one of which you've got like two non-zero k, which are about, you know, half, and then one of them where you've got three non-zero k, but one's almost one, the other two are like infinitesimal. So the third state's almost completely zero, the second state's quite close.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that sounds right. Let me think about this. Maybe I got this backwards, and it's just that maybe it's if the state is maximally entangled, then the number of non-zero lambda k is d. Yeah, there's something funny there. So let's just write what we know to be correct, and I'll think about if there's some nuance that forces this to be true as well. Okay. So let's put a little question mark there. Thanks.
In the Smith decomposition, the basis is unique.
I don't know. I think it must be. I think it is, but I'd have to check.
Because the first remark then, if it is not unique, should be in any basis, but if it's unique, then it's okay.
Should be decomposition.
Okay. It is unique, yeah. Yeah, I would think it should be, otherwise you would get a double sum. If you do any, yeah, I think it is up to U1 phases. All right. So contextuality may be the single most defining characteristic of quantum systems, what makes them non-classical. So let's look at the simplest example of it. We'll look at the Perez-Merman square. So we consider the following operators: identity, tensor sigma x, tensor identity, and sigma x. And then we take sigma y, tensor identity, identity, tensor sigma y, tensor sigma y. So consider each of this. So this is a 3 by 3 grid. We're going to consider each of these. Consider each of these operators. As a potential measurement on a 2-qubit system. Okay, by 2 qubits, I just mean 2 spin-half particles. All right, so that's fine. So we can measure just x on the second particle or just x on the first particle. We can measure any of these guys. Now, what we also want to do, and this is where it becomes an interpretational problem, we want to say, let's suppose that contrary to what Bohr insisted, we imagine that there is a pre-existing property of the quantum system that's revealed by the measurement. All right, so let's consider the possibility Okay? So we're going to entertain this possibility and derive some constraints on its viability. So let's assume that the pre-existing value corresponds to one of the outcomes of the measurement. All right, so what are the possible outcomes? Well, the eigenvalues, which are the outcomes, of any Pauli measurement, Pauli operator, are the set minus 1, plus 1.
You blast away.
Yeah. So we can denote the pre-existing value using a notation V of the Pauli operator. So say sigma x tensor sigma y is going to be an element of minus 1 plus 1. I guess here I'm, these aren't, remember the spin operators are like h bar over 2 times sigma x. So I'm just dropping the h bar over 2 and just calling it 1 and minus 1. So I guess in general, we have the value of any sigma dot n. Here, this hat means operator. This hat means unit vector. Maybe I should do it this way. Is equal to minus 1 plus 1. And similarly, the value of any pair of operators, sigma dot en tensor sigma dot en prime is also minus 1 or plus 1. Okay, so the idea here is very, very simple. It's what you would expect, that you have a measurement, it reveals some outcome, and you say, okay, well, that was the existing, that was the system had that property prior to measurement, and I discovered what that property was via measuring. So now the point is that we, when we consider this set of measurements over here, this Perez-Merman square, the key point is that the operators in each row and each column mutually commute. So remark, and you can just check this, the observables slash operators in each row and column, each row or column, mutually commute. the product of the operators in each row and column. In each row, and for the first two columns, multiply to identity, okay, so this you can check, simple thing to check. But now our rule is that the value we assign to an operator is one of the possible outcomes, which is one of its eigenvalues. So, and we demand that the value of the identity is equal to one of the eigenvalues, an eigenvalue of identity cross identity. But there's only one eigenvalue of identity, and that's 1. The operators in the third column multiply to minus identity. And of course, the only possible value assignment to the minus identity operator is minus 1. Okay, so because the operators consider like the top row, so I can go ahead and I can measure identity cross sigma x on my system, and I'll get some outcome, plus or minus 1. Then I can measure sigma x tensor identity, and I'll get some outcome, plus or minus 1. And then I'll measure x tensor x, and I'll get some outcome. Now, these commute, so I can repeat the experiment. Then I can go back and measure identity cross sigma x, and I have to get the same outcome again because these commute. So what that means is that I have some fixed set of outcomes for that row, and because I can also measure the product of all of them, so here we're going to demand for commuting operators, that the value assigned to A times the value assigned to B is equal to the value assigned to A times B. And we only demand this is true for commuting operators. So for the first row, we need the value of identity tensor sigma x times the value of sigma x tensor identity times the value of sigma x tensor sigma x to be equal to the value of identity tensor identity, which is the product of these three, because sigma x squared is identity. And this has to be equal to 1 plus 1. And similarly for every row and column except the last column. And likewise, for every row and column except the last column, for which we require that the value assigned to sigma x tensor sigma x times the value assigned to sigma y tensor sigma y times the value assigned to sigma z tensor sigma z should be equal to the value assigned to minus identity tensor identity, which is equal to minus 1. Okay, so now we already see the contradiction. We want to assume that in any given run, we can get some set of values. And we want to assume that there are pre-assigned values for every measurement we might make. Now, this is a what's called a counterfactual argument. Because in practice, I can only I have to choose one row or one column. The elements of one row won't commute with the elements of another row, necessarily, right? So, for example, sigma x tensor identity does not commute with sigma y tensor sigma y. So I can't simultaneously measure those two. I can just choose one row or one column and measure it. But I'd like to say that no matter what I eventually decide to choose, the values that I will get are being are revealed properties of the system. So I'd like to say that there exists some assignment of values that are revealed, even though I can't simultaneously test all of them. But I can test one row and one column at a time. But here we already have a contradiction, because we need some assignment of plus and minus 1 to each location in the grid. But what are the constraints? Every row has to multiply to plus 1, and the first two columns have to multiply to plus 1, but the third column has to multiply to minus 1. So here's the claim. There exists no assignment of plus minus 1 to each operator that satisfies these constraints. So we call this a proof of contextuality. Now, is it clear to everyone? Have you had a chance to just take a moment and reflect on this contradiction, like recognize that it is indeed impossible? Probably some really easy way to see it. Let me just remember. Basically, if you consider the three rows and the first two columns, you have to have either no minus signs or two minus signs in each case. And let's assume there are no minus signs in every case. So then you have no minus signs in each row. And that means, of course, you can never have the third column multiply to minus 1. So that means we need to throw some minus signs in. So you can put two minus signs in the first row and put one of them on the third column. Then we need, say we put a minus sign at entry 1, 2, which is sigma x tensor identity, and a minus 1 at entry sigma x, sigma x. Then we have to put another minus 1 somewhere in the second column, which means we have to put another minus 1 in either the second or third row somewhere. And, well, I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's a simple way to see it.
There's got to be an even number of minus signs in the entire box.
Yeah, that's it.
There's got to be an even number on the left two columns. There's got to be an odd number on the right two columns, but the even possible gives them one.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's an even-odd argument. That's the best way to do it. Thank you.
Would it be valid to say, like, I was just thinking if you start with all plus 1s and I need to have only exactly one column and all the rows be odd. If I switch stuff to minus signs, I'm always going to switch the parity of one row and one column at the same time. So like, I can never get just one column and that's it, be minus.
Or two rows or two columns.
If I switch one minus sign at a time, it'll switch one row and one column. So if I start with everything plus, then I can never get just one thing be minus.
Well, I think the even odd parity is simpler.
It might be the same. It might be the same thing.
Simpler to see.
We know it's true. There's probably multiple different ways of proving it.
I mean, the even odd argument is the consequence of that if you put one minus and that you're changing the parity one row then one
row. So it's basically the same thing.
Okay, so basically one of our assumptions is false, as before. It's a no-go theorem. So why do they call it contextuality? The idea is that the natural way, the most natural way to overcome this no-go theorem is to say that the value of, say, this operator, identity tensor sigma x, the value I'm going to get when I measure it isn't necessarily a pre-existing value, but rather it depends on the context in which identity sigma x is measured. So maybe that's clearest if I look at x tensor x, because x tensor x is in the third column. So the idea is that the value assigned to x tensor x depends on if I measure it along with this commuting set, whoops, or if I measure it along with the commuting set associated with the third column. Notice that those are two different experimental setups. So if I want to build an apparatus that's going to measure sigma x tensor sigma x, I can build it as part of a system which is capable of measuring identity tensor sigma x and sigma x tensor identity, or I can build it as part of a context in which it can measure yy and zz along with xx. So these are two different experimental configurations which are incompatible. And so, you know, Bohr says a lot of things that I disagree with, but here he said something which is very perceptive about contextuality. And he says basically that the measuring instruments serve to define the conditions under which the phenomena appear. So this is the basic idea of contextuality, that we can't think about an operator like this is having some pre-existing value independently of specifying how you went about measuring it. So that's the terminology. There's a few more things I can tell you about this. So this is a more recent demonstration of contextuality. Well, it's from the 90s or something, in a four-dimensional Hilbert space. Contextuality was first proved by Bell and Koshin and Specker. In 1967-ish, independently. So Bell had his own proof, and then Koshin-Specker had a better proof. The Koshin-Specker proof involves 117 vectors in a three-dimensional Hilbert space.
It's good to carry the metal kind of cut back again.
Yeah, so I mean, here's the point. This is why this is important. So Prez and Merman found a simple way to do this for a composite system. Now, we already know from Bell's theorem that there's some very funny things happening when you think about composite systems due to entanglement. The remarkable thing about the Koshin-Specker theorem, as proven originally, is that it applies to a single three-level system. So the idea is you consider three measurements. Let me start counting from zero. 1 and 2. So here the idea is that these are orthogonal measurements, so this is a basis for the Hilbert space. So if I want to measure a system, I can measure in this basis. And I can get some probability of 0, some probability of 1, some probability of 2. Those are probabilities. In any given run, if I just have one system and I measure in this basis, I'm going to get one outcome. And that outcome will either be 0, 1, or 2. So I have some assignment. I have some assignment. Which is an element of 0 or 1. Either I get an outcome for that projector or I don't. And we know that the sum over I of VI has to be equal to 1, because I can only get one outcome. So if I get the outcome 0, then I definitely don't get the outcome 1. So these are the constraints. And then what they did is they said, OK, now let's do this. Let's rotate 1 and 2 to some new this is bad notation. I'll call it 1 prime and 2 prime. OK, so the point is 0 belongs to a basis which consists of 0, 1, and 2, which is orthonormal. 0 also belongs to a basis which is 0, 1 prime, and 2 prime, where I've just rotated the subspace 1, 2. And now similarly, we have VI prime has to be 0 or 1. And we have V0, 0 plus sum over I prime equals 1 to 2. Sorry, V of this has to equal 1. So notice there's a constraint now, because if I measured 0, 1, and 2 and the outcome was 1, so I'm revealing the pre-existing property, the system had the property 1. Think of it as having, like, if it's a spin 1 particle, it can have spin 1, 0, or minus 1. Yeah, this corresponds to spin 0. But if this is a 1, then 0 has to be 0 from this constraint. But that means if 0 is a 0, that means when I think about measuring the prime basis, one of these has to be a 1. And similarly, if I put the 1 on the 0, then these both have to be 0, 1 and 2, and 1 prime and 2 prime. So then they went around and built a graph where they considered these triads, and they kept each triad shared one basis element. And that set up a graph with a whole bunch of constraints on it, that any vector that was belonged to two different triads had to satisfy a constraint, in that if it was 1, the values assigned to the first triad constrained the values you could assign to the next triad. And they did this for 117 vectors, and showed that there was no consistent assignment of ones and zeros. So Koch and Specker constructed a set of triads, which are just three-level bases, which involved 117 vectors.
Where is the number 117?
I'm hoping it's divisible by 3, or I'm misremembering things. So, well, it's been improved. So since then, people have reduced this down to, I think, 17 vectors is the world record. So I'm just giving you the historical. So people have, Perez and Adán Cabello, have reduced the number of vectors you need to find the contradiction. And proved that no consistent assignment of 0, 1 existed. Which means that because each of these triads consists of a different possible measurement I could perform, that means I can't think of these as revealing some prior property of the system. In other words, whether or not I get outcome yes for 0 depends on the context of whether I'm measuring it along with 1 and 2 or along with 1 prime and 2 prime, which of course is part of specifying the full disposition of the apparatus. But it's weird because the probabilities, the part of quantum mechanics that we can verify experimentally, the probability of getting outcome 0 for some state is independent of the context in which I measure it, right? Similarly, the expectation value of any of these operators, I can tell you what that is without knowing which column or row you're measuring it in, right? So what I compare when I do a series, an ensemble of repetitions, and I get long-run statistics, and I calculate a probability or an expectation value, that data is independent of the context. But my ability to describe an individual outcome depends on the context. Quantum prediction, which consists of a probability or an expectation value, for some vector I, some projector I, or some observable, you know, sigma dot n, tensor sigma dot n, I called it en, I guess. Is independent of the context. Sorry, that's a bit sloppy. Let me just read it out. The context dependence of the individual outcome assignments is surprising because the quantum predictions, which is, say, a probability of outcome 0, or an expectation of one of these poly operators, is independent of the context in which it's measured. Now, the last thing that I can tell you about that's really cool, well, it's the last thing, but probably, is that non-locality from Bell's theorem is a special case of this. Okay, how's that the case? Let me just tell you in words, and then maybe I can write something down to summarize it. So remember the Bell experiment. The idea is that Alice and Bob, let's call this Alice. So Alice has, remember, she can measure, she can set a knob on her device which picks what she's measuring. A0 or A1, I think, was the notation. Right, so she's measuring her spin along some axis. And so she picks that axis. And then Bob independently picks some axis system B0 and B1 that he's going to measure. Now we know in the long run statistics, the probabilities that Alice gets for her measurement of A0 are independent of what Bob chooses. And that's important because that's what guarantees no signaling. Right? That's why we can't just take like 100 spins and then entangled spins, and then Alice chooses some measurement. You know, if I'm Bob, I can't affect her statistics by changing my measurement because that would be signaling. I could send a space-like separated signal instantaneously. But what we show by the theorem is that if we want to understand the individual outcomes of these experiments, and if we assumed that Alice's outcome is independent of Bob's setting, then we find an upper bound on this quantity S. So one way to understand what non-locality is telling us is that somehow in each run, the outcome that Alice gets depends on the context of what measurement setting Bob chose. So when we, remember, we assume parameter independence, which was that Alice's outcomes don't depend in any way on Bob's parameter settings, which was his choice of measurement. But here we're seeing that, in fact, that led to a contradiction with quantum mechanics. So we can understand Bell's theorem as a proof of contextuality, because it's showing that Alice's outcomes depend on the context of what Bob chose, even though at the statistical level, we can't see that context dependence, and so can't signal. So the Cochin-Specker theorem focuses on an individual system where it's more plausible. Well, look, if I'm measuring this or this, there could be something about my apparatus which influences the outcome I get depending on how I devised it. But the contextuality is more surprising in Bell's setting, because here we can make the event space-like separated. So we see no possible causal mechanism for Alice's outcome to depend on Bob's setting. Whereas you can imagine some hidden causal mechanism in the three-level setting. We can't imagine one. Well, we can't imagine a local one. But the important point is that even in the local setting of a three-level system, quantum mechanics gives no mechanism for that causal dependence. There's no story for why the outcome you get for zero depends on whether you measure it with one and two or one prime and two prime. So there's something funny going on where the formal structure of quantum mechanics is not telling us about this other level of causal influence, which seems to be relevant if we want a causal story. Now, of course, one solution to this is just abandon hopes for a causal story. But another solution is to imagine that there is some causal story, and let's take this as a hint about how to characterize that causal story.
So Joe,
yeah.
What does this mean? You have to, what constraint does this say put on? Say we have invariables, invariables series. I mean, obviously something. But I think this Bell's inequality implies we need to be non-local, right? And what does this imply for what constraints does this imply for like the hidden extra invariables?
Sorry, I was trying to multitask there, but I think I... What does it tell us about the hidden variables?
What does it tell us about hidden variables?
It tells us that they're contextual. So a really cool paper came out last year by someone named Peter Blasiak. I think it was maybe 2012 even. But he gives a model for contextuality for the Perez-Merman square, a hidden variable model for it. And it's actually epistemic in the sense that quantum states correspond to lack of knowledge about some hidden property. So his ontology, or his physical properties, imagine each qubit corresponds to, you have a cube, and the vertices of the cube are the possible values of the hidden variable. And he has this really clever trick where, I mean, we already know this, that you have to, when you do a measurement quantum mechanically, you have to disturb the system in some way. So normally people assume that that is only the case when you go from non-commuting operators. If I measure position, I disturb momentum because they don't commute. He involves a disturbance even for commuting operators. And so that's like a creative idea he came up with. And what he showed was that if you allow a disturbance for commuting operators, he devised a really clever way for that disturbance to not show up at the statistical level, but to show up at the level of individual events, and managed to demonstrate contextual behavior in this toy system in that the outcomes you got from the measurement didn't correspond. So everything had a pre-existing value. There was some definite, you were on some definite corner of the cube, and your measurements corresponded to checking, am I on the right side or the left side or the front or the back of the cube? But when you did the measurement, it transformed the, where the ball, where the point was on the cube. So you would measure x identity tensor x and then x tensor identity, and you would get the revealed values. But when you did that, it would change the physical state to be consistent with the value you got. So in other words, finding x equals plus 1, there are four corners of the cube that give x equals plus 1. And so the system would start out on one corner of the cube that gives x equals plus 1. Maybe the preparation was on the front face of the cube, and then the x measurement is the right face of the cube. And so it was on the front face in the right-hand corner, and so the x measurement said, okay, you get plus 1. But then when you do that measurement, it randomly rotates the point along that face, which is still consistent with the plus 1 measurement. So there are several physical properties that correspond to that outcome. And then when you do the x tensor x measurement, you get some outcome, which is the property the system has before you do xx, but it's not the property the system had before you started all your measurements. So that was a very clever trick that gave us some insight into how you can have contextuality in a way that satisfies all of these constraints. So I found that paper to be pretty inspirational. But the problem is, he asked, it only works for some very, for some constrained set of measurements. So how to generalize that to get a full 2-qubit hidden variable model is an open question. But I'd look that up if you're interested in this. It's a really, really clever insight. And then maybe if I can just quickly tell you, just kind of sketch a result from my own research program this past couple years. So we managed to show, so people like Rob Speckens and others have really highlighted that contextuality is the most primitive thing about quantum mechanics, which seems to identify why it's not classical. So, you know, not superposition, not entanglement, but contextuality. And so what my group did is we were looking at how to understand the power of quantum computing and whether we could connect that to contextuality. So as you know or have heard, the idea is a quantum computer can do things can't be done with the classical computer. It can solve problems efficiently that can't be solved efficiently, or we don't think can be solved efficiently on a classical computer. And there are a variety of models of quantum computing. There's the circuit model, and there's the measurement-based model, and there's this obscure model from Ray Laflamme and Manny Nil called the power of 1-qubit model, where they only have 1-qubit in a pure state, and all the rest of them are in a mixed state. And they show that you can still get an advantage. But that's surprising, because that quantum computer has almost no entanglement. It has almost no purity in it. It's completely mixed. So there's this outstanding question in the field, which is, what features of quantum mechanics are the ingredients that are necessary to achieve the capabilities of quantum computing? And, you know, people have proposed entanglement, but that's problematic. People have proposed this thing called discord, and that's even more problematic. So we were trying to connect it with contextuality, and we managed to do that. So we managed to show, and in this particular model of quantum computing called the magic state model of quantum computing, we managed to show that that model for quantum computing can achieve universal quantum computing and an advantage over classical computing only if you could construct a, if you could violate a contextuality inequality. So let me tell you what a contextuality inequality is. Notice that in the Perez-Mermin square, this is called a state-independent proof of contextuality. Because I didn't tell you anything about what the input state is. I just considered the algebraic properties of the observables and showed that no matter what state you start with, there's no assignment, no pre-existing set of values that are consistent with the possible measurement outcomes you could get. But if we look, think about Bell's theorem, where we see that we see this context dependence, we violate parameter independence. There it's state dependent. It's only if the state is entangled, sufficiently entangled, that we see that effect, that we see a violation of Bell's theorem. So you can think of Bell's theorem or the CHSH inequality as a state-dependent proof of contextuality. In other words, you only have contextuality for certain input states for that set of observables you're considering. So similarly, we looked at a family of contextuality inequalities that were state-dependent contextuality inequalities and showed that a necessary condition for the input states to allow this model of computing, this magic state model of quantum computing, to achieve an advantage over a classical computer was that those states violated contextuality inequality. So this is a result by Howard et al. And this was in Nature this year. We showed actually, they're called non-contextuality inequalities. And I think that's, again, very satisfying because, you know, the whole property, the properties of non-locality and contextuality become manifest when you imagine that quantum states are states of knowledge about some underlying physical properties. And here, the fact that we see that that point of view heralds capabilities. So the fact that you can violate a CHSH inequality tells you there's something special going on. And that's a resource for quantum communication, quantum key distribution, and so on. Similarly, what we've shown is that the fact that, you know, when the hidden variable picture breaks down and starts showing odd behavior, contextual behavior, that's exactly when you see, when you reach some threshold that allows you to perform quantum computation, outperform classical computation. So I think these are promising insights. And yet, but the complete story is still not clear. Okay, good. So maybe there's some more questions about contextuality. And then we move on to Poisson brackets. No?
Is it possible to violate contextuality with a single two-level system?
No. So, I should have said. So
that's a three-level system.
Yeah, so the contextuality only happens for three levels and larger. So for two-level systems, actually, all the phenomena of the qubit, there exists a beautiful hidden variable theory that reproduces all the physics of the qubit. Called the Cochin Specker model. So when Cochin and Specker realized that their proof only worked for d greater than or equal to 3, Cochin Specker theorem applies for d greater than or equal to 3. And then they gave an explicit non-contextual model for the qubit. Which reproduces all the physics of the qubit. Quite simply, you imagine that your physical state space is a two-sphere. And if I prepare spin up, then I prepare a probability density on the two-sphere like this, where this the probability weight is given by the inner product of, you know what, I should be able to do this off the top of my head, but maybe I shouldn't get into it too much. But so this is a Z-up preparation. The Z-up state corresponds to this probability density on on the two sphere, on the sphere. And then a measurement corresponds to, suppose I'm measuring in this direction on the two sphere. Then what I can do is I can draw an evenly weighted hemisphere here. So this is an indicator function. It's checking, is the physical state in this hemisphere or not? So remember, the idea is when I prepare Z up, I prepare a vector randomly distributed on the upper hemisphere with a weighting given by this cos theta function. It's cos theta. And then if I do a measurement in some direction, I'm just checking if the actual state I created is in the hemisphere. So notice that this state and this measurement intersect on this section of the two-sphere. So then the idea is that the probability, so because I prepared this vector uniformly according to this probability distribution, if I then measure along this axis, there's some probability that vector is in this region. And you exactly reproduce the Born rule probability. So for a single qubit, we can understand all the physics of the qubit in terms of some simple hidden variable model, this non-contextual.
Does it generalize to PRVM?
It actually doesn't. So this is something that my student proved a few years ago, we never published. But you can show that you can't reproduce. If your Nyemark dilation of the POVM requires an Ancilla Hilbert space, then you cannot reproduce the POVM statistics, because essentially you're implicitly using a bigger Hilbert space. And then the quotient-Speckert theorem kicks in. So yeah, so it's limited to projective measurements, all density operators and projective measurements of a single qubit. So this is called the quotient-Speckert model.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure Lucien will follow up on these things. And then, I think I have one more whiteboard, but I did it in the wrong order. Okay. It was a little bit about contextuality, a bit confusing. You guys look a bit. Is there a question?
Yeah, I guess I don't. Does this like bolster or sort of make cast doubt on the whole purely information probabilistic view?
Okay. I mean, that's a good question, and I think that it does both. Right. What it shows is that it tells us how to. What are the constraints on the ways in which you can construct a model for quantum theory that reproduces quantum mechanics and yet gives us a realistic view of the world? And then the question is, I mean, so that it bolsters it in the sense that it clarifies the path forward, but if it also brings in aspects that might seem implausible based on intuition. So for example, that's clearest from the case of Bell's theorem, where some people like to hold the principle of locality as, you know, necessary for any path forward. And what Bell's theorem shows is that, well, if you're going to have any kind of realist view underlying quantum mechanics, or just assume the wave function is physical for that matter, you have to allow some form of non-locality in that picture. So if you find that to be implausible, then it's an obstacle to it. But if you find that plausible, then it's not an obstacle. It clarifies the right way to think, the way to think about things.
Right. So if I assume the wave function is not physical, it's just like a slightly different kind of probability theory, then I don't see why I would even care about locality in the first place. Like, or what do you mean by locality in that sense then?
Well, what I mean by locality is that you would like to think that there are no causal influences between space-like separated events. Even,
right.
I mean, special relativity tells us right. There are no signals between space-like separated events.
Yeah.
But for a lot of people, including Einstein, the idea of any kind of causal relationship between space-like separated events is implausible. So Einstein is on the record as saying, in spite of his, you know, commitment to the idea of hidden variables, he also, he died before Bell's theorem. It would have been, you know, wonderful to know Einstein's response in light of Bell's theorem. But based on what he said prior to Bell's theorem, he would have been faced with quite a dilemma, because on the one hand, he held firm that there were hidden variables, but on the other hand, he held firm that there should be no causal influences that were not for space-like separated events. And Bell showed that you can't hold both of those views simultaneously.
It just, it seems weird, like, for instance, if we take a Bell state and say, like, you know, first up, down, down, up, or whatever, and even if they're causally separated, if we just say that we've prepared a state where one spins up, the other spin is always the opposite spin, then we don't know anything about it until we look at it, so I don't see.
The thing is, you can measure spin X.
Yeah, I mean, here, I mean, just remember with the assumptions of Bell's theorem, the trick about Bell's theorem was it wasn't just doing simple measurements, it was doing these measurements which were at a 45-degree angle, and then managed to show that if you assume there are no causal influences, then you cannot reproduce the quantum statistics.
Right.
Basically, that's the main idea. You can't reproduce the quantum statistics. So you have to allow either some kind of non-local variable or some kind of causal influence that's faster than light. OK. So anyways, this is stuff to think about. Let's just set it aside now and move on to another topic, which I'll at least be able to introduce, which is the Poisson bracket formulation of quantum and classical mechanics. Okay, so what's the Poisson bracket? The Poisson bracket satisfies several properties, five properties: antisymmetry, so in much of the way that we define the Lie bracket, the Poisson bracket has a little bit more structure. So F and G are just elements of some algebra. Poisson bracket is a rule that takes as, you know, two inputs. It's antisymmetric, it's linear. So we have the Poisson bracket of AF plus BGH is equal to H to our list here. Where A and B are just some scalars. Let's see if I can squeeze in a third one down here. We're going to also have Leibniz's law. I think four of these are satisfied by the Lie bracket. I don't remember which four, though. the Jacobi identity. And thirdly, we assume that there are distinguished elements of the algebra. X and P satisfying xi pj is equal to delta ij. xi xj is equal to 0. And pi pj also equal to 0. Okay, so think of f and g as polynomial functions of x and p. F, g, and h are, okay, so the other point is we, f, g, and h are some polynomials in x and p. So the idea is that x and p are going to correspond to our observables, and f, g, and h, or our canonical coordinates, are primitive degrees of freedom. And f, g, and h are just some functions, Hamiltonians or whatever, you can construct out of these q, x's and p's. I could call them q's and p's, I guess, maybe clearer. OK, so the point is we have this algebra generated by x and p, and we define this bracket on that algebra, which satisfies the following conditions. And if we have an algebra satisfying all this, then it's called a Poisson algebra. Okay, so that's just some abstraction. And now we can do, I'll go over here. Now we can get classical mechanics. So we're also going to assume a dynamical law. So for some f of x, you know, let me just change this x to a q because that's better. So this is all q. We assume there's some special, there's some f of q and a parameter time. And an energy function h of q, p, and t we have the df by dt is equal to the Poisson bracket of f and h. So this is a postulate. So we postulate this. This is our dynamical law. Now the question is, what kind of theory do we get? So now here's where we make a distinction. Now we have to decide, is this algebra commutative or non-commutative? Which maybe you can motivate by thinking about, you know, can I, if I do sequential measurements, of Q and P, does it matter what order I do them in or not? So maybe that's some operational motivation for what we mean by commutative or non-commutative. So now classical mechanics. We assume Q and P are commutative. More precisely, the algebra is commutative. Then it turns out we can ask, well, what's a representation of the Poisson bracket? Okay, so then there exists a representation of the Poisson bracket of the form FG is equal to, here I'm choosing some three-dimensional space, X, Y, Z, and I have n particles in three dimensions. So I have a Q and a P associated with each degree of freedom, X, Y, and Z for each particle. And then the Poisson bracket of F and G can be evaluated in the following way. We take partial derivatives with respect to each of the coordinates. Okay, this might look familiar from your classical mechanics course. The point is that it's a representation of it. So if I consider this right-hand side, it's going to satisfy all five properties that I specified for the Poisson bracket. So the point is, if I want to evaluate, if I tell you F is, you know, Q squared and G is P cubed, how do I evaluate what the Poisson bracket of that is? Well, I can actually use the formal properties here to reduce that expression. I can use the Jacobi identity and Leibniz's law to evaluate that and get some answer, which will be just some new other polynomial of Q and P. And this will come into play. Or I can just calculate these partial derivatives. And that's another route to finding the answer. And the two will agree, assuming that the algebra is commutative. Now we can use this representation and evaluate this dynamical law in terms of this bracket. So we can substitute 2 into 1. And what we get is the df by dt is equal to, let's just look at it for one particle in one dimension. We get df by dt is equal to df by dq, dh by dp, minus df by dp, dh by dq, plus del f by del t. All right. So now, I don't know if I should keep going or.
Well, I have to finish the classical. I'm going to get Liouville's equation, and then I can do the quantum mechanical one, which will give us Schrodinger's equation. So it's going to take a little while.
Yeah, I think we might be better. If you can just recap that.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll continue this tomorrow, and then I think the other thing you guys wanted to see was the treatment of interventions. So we'll finish this up and then discuss the interdimensional stuff tomorrow. So if you have any questions about this, anyways, I'm here for lunch, and feel free to chat with me.